Chapter 15. Israel's Final Defiance. Israel the Brandenburg, the young Saxon painter and miniaturist who arrived at Trent on the occasion of the fateful Passover of 1475 on one of his frequent trips to the cities of the Trevenator region in search of clients, Jews and Christians, was the first to opt for a rapid conversion to Christianity. He had already successfully braved the baptismal waters by the time the interrogations of the principal persons implicated in the child murder of Simon began in late 1475. Wolfgang was given a new name selected for him by Hindelbach, in honor of a saint for whom the Prince Bishop of Trent showed particular affection. As Wolfgang was to confess at a later time, he had decided to abjure the faith of his father simply in the hope of saving his skin. And the circumstances proved him right. Or at least, they proved him right, at first. 2 months later, by the end of June, upon conclusion of the first phase of the trials, the principal defendants, 9 in total, including Samuel de Nuremberg, Angelo de Verona and the physician Tobias de Magdeburg, were condemned to death and executed. The old man Mose de Würzburg had died in prison before being sentenced to execution. The trials were then all temporarily suspended by order of the Archduke of Austria, Sigismund. A few of the minor defendants, all of them from among the servants to the two principal moneylenders and the physician Tobias, were in prison waiting to learn their fate. By contrast, the women of the small community were confined under house arrest in Samuel F.'s house, kept under surveillance by the bishop's gendarmes. Giovanni Hindelbach had taken a liking to the young convert, Israel Wolfgang, and had demonstrated his trust in him by admitting him freely to the castle and allowing him to sit at table among his servants and courtiers. But his trust was not entirely disinterested. In the summer of 1475, Wolfgang, the convert painter, was in fact the only Christian in Trent who could read and understand Hebrew. This knowledge was indispensable to the young bishop, who, having confiscated the goods of the condemned, found himself in need of someone capable of deciphering the bank ledgers of the Jews, drawn up, as was normally the case, in Hebrew. The value of the pledges and their ownership by the citizens of Trent or foreigners could only be determined by means of a correct interpretation of the entries appearing in those books. In early June, Hindelbach decided officially to entrust Israel Wolfgang with the paid task of supervising the restitution and redemption of the collateral amassed in the vaults of the Jewish banks. The Saxon painter's new workplace was now the money-lending shop formerly owned by the deceased Samuel de Nuremberg. Here, the young Wolfgang spent a great part of his time, working diligently and capably. But at the same time, Israel Wolfgang had simultaneously decided to use his conversion as a disguise, permitting him more easily to help the Jewish women confined under house arrest, facilitating their escape and expatriation. He secretly informed his influential and powerful protector of these intentions, Salomone the Pio di Sacco, who had allowed Wolfgang to stay in his home as a guest, allowing him to meet his family and learn their secrets. The nearby city of Revere too, located in the high valley of Lagarina, which belonged to the Republic of Venice and was therefore outside Bishop Hindelbach's jurisdiction, had been selected as the general headquarters of the representatives of the Ashkenazi community of the Veneto region for the task of making every effort to obtain the release of those defendants still in prison in Trent, and to invalidate the trials. Salomone Cusai, sent to Rovereto by Salomone Depiov, informed anyone who needed to know of Israel Wolfgang's full preparedness to bring about the prisoners' release, particularly the women, quickly, and without attracting attention. Jacob of Brescia, Jacob di Bonventura de Riva, and Cresson de Nuremberg, some of the more prominent exponents of the lobby gathered at Rovereto, were perfectly well aware of the dangerous mission which the bold young Saxon, camouflaged as a Christian, had voluntarily assumed. Jacob de Brescia was the brother of Risedo, accused of being one of the principal recipients of the blood originating from the Regensburg child murder. The moneylender did business at Gavedo, in the Bresciano region, and, in testimony of his authority, in 1467, Milanese officials referred to him as the Jew who is the head of the other Jews. For more than a decade, from 1475 to 1488, Jacob di Bonventura de Riva was generally considered the most influential banker at Riva del Garda. Cresson Gerson was another highly prominent Ashkenazi Jew. A native of Nuremberg, he had reached Rovereto around 1460, but he had only received authorization from the Doge Niccolo Tron to bring his daughter and the family's movable capital from his native city in 1471. Starting in 1465, a patrician from Rovereto, Delfino Frizzi, had permitted him to live in his palace and to become associated with the Adige River navigation business. In his spare time, Cresson de Nuremberg also worked successfully in the money trade, an activity which often took him to the principal centers of the zone, including Riva del Garda. In the summer of 1475, the air at Trent was charged with tension. The minds of both Jews and Christians were filled with uncertainty about the fate of the defendants still in prison, as well as concern for the executed defendants' wives and children. Israel Wolfgang and his diligent collaborators were concerned with the total confiscation of all the defendants' property, the redemption of the collateral deposited in their shops, the reimbursement of all sums borrowed, promptly convoyed in Hinderbach's strong boxes. In the meantime, as we have seen, the Dominican Battista de Gadisi, Bishop of Ventimiglia, the Pope's delegate commissioner, moved from Rome to Trent to shed light on Simon's murder and to search for errors by the Prince Bishop, suspected of having deliberately manipulated the trials towards the resulting conclusion. Before Pope Sixtus IV, Salomone de Piov insistently supported the sending of this commissioner to save those defendants still in prison and to muffle the undesirable scandal threatening to overwhelm the other German Jewish communities of northern Italy, jeopardizing delicate interests and laboriously captured positions while irremediably upsetting the political hinterland which had made these interests possible. In August 1475, on the road to Trent, the commissioner of the judges was crossing the Veneto with a small retinue of functionaries and collaborators. It seems that they were accompanied by three Jews, who joined them traveling from the region of Padua. Two of these are easily identifiable as Salomone de Piov and Salomone Fustunga. Perhaps the third was the brother of Risedo de Regensburg, Jacob de Brescia, returning from Rovereto. Fustunga, the unscrupulous wheeler dealer and expert intriguer with a thousand resources and influential and multifarious contacts, was probably identical with one of the most prominent figures in Germandry, transplanted to the Veneto region. This person was Salamanida Campazampia, who, together with Salamanida Piov, a friend and colleague, maintained despotic control over the money trade at Padua and the district. Battista de Gadisi entered Trent in the early part of the month of September, taking up quarters at the Albergo Alla Rosa, in the Via dell'Osteri Grandi, from which the wharf of Bonconsiglio was quite visible. He courteously declined Bishop Hinderbach's invitation to be his guest at the castle, probably intending to control his meetings and movements in this way, on the grounds that the inn, although German-owned, was well known for its appetizing Italian cuisine, a quality particularly appreciated by the Dominican Inquisitor, who considered himself a man of good taste, not one disposed to compromise in culinary matters. The Gadisi was escorted by a small retinue, including his assistant Trafili, a one-eyed notary, blind in one eye, who knew German and could act as an interpreter, and a mysterious priest, old and hunchbacked, who always wore a torn black frock coat. The Albergo Alla Rosa also hosted Salamone Fustunga, the influential wheeler dealer who accompanied the apostolic commissioner with prudence and circumspection, meeting him frequently and speaking Italian, without need for an intermediary of any kind. Israel Wolfgang was now required to respect the delicate and dangerous commitments which he had voluntarily assumed. The young Saxon had been duly warned of the Gadidai's arrival by Salomon Ilopiov, and knew that Fustunga would contact him, Wolfgang, immediately. They met at night, in the stalls of the Albergo Alla Rosa, far from prying eyes. Fustunga informed Wolfgang that Gasparo, assistant to Sigismondo's steward, had procured a safe conduct for him, Wolfgang, to travel to Innsbruck and confer with the Archduke of Austria in order to obtain a definitive suspension of the trials and the release of the imprisoned women. He also asked Wolfgang to make himself available to the apostolic commissioner through the one-eyed notary, who knew German, and to deliver secret messages to the women, confined in Samuel de Nuremberg's house, messages to be transmitted to Wolfgang from the general headquarters of the Ashkenazi Jews, set up in Revier II. The women were reassured, and informed of the good prospects of Wolfgang's mission before Sigismondo and the commissioner's full readiness to do everything possible to obtain their release. Fustunga entrusted Israel Wolfgang with money for his expenses and trouble. The next day, it was the one-eyed notary's turn to take the initiative of meeting Israel Wolfgang. The location of the appointment was the stub near the fountain behind the Chiesa di San Pietro, a public bath in a discreet area of Trent where the streets were usually empty. The notary informed the young painter that he would soon be called upon to talk with the commissioner and, knowing that Wolfgang could freely enter the rooms of the castle of Bonconsiglio, he asked Wolfgang to spy on Hinderbach's movements and to inform him, the notary, Raffili, of any rumors going around at the castle relating to the Jews still held in jail as well as on the eventuality of a resumption of the trials. For his part, Israel Wolfgang warned the one-eyed notary that he intended to continue to avoid the Jews so as not to awaken suspicion, informing him, in the meantime, of what he had succeeded in gleaning from the information floating around. A rumor was current at Trent that the apostolic commissioner was in cahoots with the Jews and proposed to exonerate all those condemned for Simon's murder, and bring about the release of anyone still in prison, including the women. In this regard, Israel Wolfgang knew that Hinderbach was not at all prepared to permit Batista de Gadisi to meet the women for the purpose of interrogating them, and therefore expressed his intention to remove them from house arrest in Samuel S. dwelling and throw them in prison, in separate cells. With his usual circumspection, Salomone Fustunger, before leaving for Trent on his way back from Innsbruck, had contacted another person, considered a certain friend of the Jewish families. This was Roper, known as Schneider Judd, a German known as the tailor to the Jews, who had for years frequented their houses and was linked to them through strong ties of solidarity. For these reasons, he was arrested during the first phase of the trials and subjected to torture. But he confessed nothing, obviously because he knew nothing. He had finally been released and remained a friend to the Jews, although with justifiable caution. We must not, therefore, be surprised that Schneider decided to go to Revier too to meet the representatives of the Ashkenazi Jews, offering them his assistance. During the meeting, he was informed by Salomone Cusai, Salomone the Piov's delegate, and Cressone de Revier II of Fustunger's planned mission before the Archduke Sigismondo. Now Fustunger now signed Schneider, directly, with the same tasks as Israel Wolfgang, that is, first of all, that of keeping contact with the women, and bringing them letters and information. Israel Wolfgang and Roper Schneider had become the Jewish woman's messenger boys, their only precious source of information, the only chink onto external reality. But they had to be careful to avoid discovery. The bishop's soldiers, in fact, occupied Samuel S. house, in which the women were confined, guarding the external door. The Saxon painter could easily enter the house, since it contained some of the late banker's collateral, but if he was caught talking to the women he would arouse the gendarmes' justifiable suspicions. The solution was to communicate orally, in the courtyard located at the rear of the house, where the women faced a small balcony overlooking the stall. Any letters sent to them, as well as any letters written in response, by contrast, were exchanged through a chink dug in the surrounding wall. Sarah, Maestro Tobias' widow, and with her, Bella and Anna, were informed by Israel Wolfgang of the commissioner's favorable attitude towards them, as well as his plans to liberate them and the hopes linked to Fustunger's ambassadorship at Innsbruck. In the letters sent from Revier II and written in Hebrew, Fustunger himself, with Jacob of Arco and Cressone, asked the women for detailed information about the conditions of their imprisonment and any coercive methods employed by Hinderbach to make them confess. For his part, Israel Wolfgang was now fully committed, working diligently and enthusiastically in the desperate attempt to free Sarah and the other prisoners. The intrepid Saxon painter was thus compelled, despite himself, to neglect the graces of his mistress, Ursula Oberdorfia, a prosperous local beauty with whom he was accustomed to entertain himself concealed at Angelo's Tavern, in the San Pietro district. To seal his love, Israel had recently given the young lady, who was, of course, a Christian, a precious silver ring with a valuable stone, obviously taken from Samuel S. pledges, which he was supposed to safeguard. The same apostolic commissioner convened Israel Wolfgang to his room in the inn, in the wee small hours of the morning, under maximum secrecy. All of the Gerdesi's collaborators were there, Raffili, the secretary responsible for drawing up the minutes. The one-eyed notary, who knew German and who acted as a translator, and a hunchback priest in a black cassock, invited under oath to set forth his version of the facts. The young Jew, now nominally a Christian, told of the horrible tortures to which the accused, all innocent, had been subjected during trial, for the purpose of extorting their confessions. Hinderbach and his jailers were accused of orchestrating a colossal injustice accompanied by ignoble machinations, all for profit. The Jews of Trent were said to be the mere victims of a pitiless theorem. Theorem equals an indicative conditional, if a, then b, intended to demonstrate their guilt at all costs. Israel Wolfgang was later to admit that he lied to the commissioner, in his effort to be of some assistance to the poor women who were still in prison. Interrupting the painter's domesticated report, the one-eyed notary asked him whether he could do something to help the women escape from their involuntary abode. The response was in the negative. Gendarmes were everywhere and were determined to be effective guards, subjecting Sarah and her companions in misfortune to strict supervision. As early as late September, Salomone Fustunger returned to Trent, disillusioned by his meeting with Sigismondo at Innsbruck. The Archduke had in fact refused to intervene to free the prisoners and was persuaded that the trials should resume for the purpose of arriving at a final determination of the defendant's guilt or innocence. The path was now free for Hinderbach, who had probably exerted pressure on Sigismondo to obtain a decision of this kind. For his part, Fustunger, angered by the unexpected failure of his mission, was now resolutely determined to avenge himself upon the implacable Bishop of Trent by dispatching him to his creator, perhaps in the company of his collaborators. And he knew he had a bold assassin at hand, prepared to do the job. Israel Wolfgang was urgently summoned to the usual meeting place, at night. In the stalls of the Alla Rosa Inn, Fustunger informed Wolfgang of the negative outcome of the appointment with Sigismondo and asked him to carry out an immediate plan to terminate Hinderbach's existence by poisoning. The poison was to be put in his food while circumventing the many precautions with which the prudent bishop had thought fit to protect his life. The young painter, eager to carry out the new mission entrusted to him, carefully examined Hinderbach's habits at table. All dishes and wine placed on the table were tasted by various persons on three occasions, that is, by the cook, in the kitchen, by the steward, in putting the dish on the sideboard, and by the waiter, in placing it on table. The poison therefore had to be placed in the food after the last servant had tasted it. Israel Wolfgang said he was capable of choosing the right time, but needed to find the raw material, an effective and lethal poison. Upon his return to the castle at Bonconsiglio, he quickly set to work. Among the stationery materials in the office, Israel Wolfgang knew there was a box containing materials belonging to a friend and colleague who had recently died, Friar Pietro, a German who had earned his living as a painter, miniaturist, and occasionally as an alchemist. The ingredients used by the monk in preparing his colors were bound to include some solid arsenic. Israel Wolfgang was not mistaken, a respectable chunk of red arsenic, or cinnabar-colored arsenic sulfide, soon found its way into his pockets. The next night, the Saxon painter hasted to meet Fustunger again. With justifiable satisfaction, Wolfgang showed him the poison he had obtained. But the astute and expert German go-getter only needed a glance to realize that Wolfgang's lump of bisulfide of arsenic was almost harmless, and would never have troubled the Bishop of Trent with anything more serious than a passing bellyache. At any rate, he offered to supply his young assassin as quickly as possible with good arsenic, capable of poisoning the bishop effectively. But for a variety of reasons, the project, although never formally abandoned, was to take another course, and Israel Wolfgang is not thought to have seen Salomone Fustunger again. Battista de Gadisi wasn't discouraged either. Unable to meet the women and other defendants due to Hindrebach's refusal, he concluded that he could do little by remaining at Trent. The hostile and intimidating climate, as he saw it, in which he was compelled to work, actually prevented him from making the desired progress in his inquiry. The failure of Salomone Fustunger's mission to Sigismondo, of which de Gadisi had been duly informed, was only an obvious prelude to the imminent resumption of the trials, leaving him with very little time in which to work, carrying the dossiers to Rome with only moderate hope that the appeals process might be approved and that the defendants might be released before they suffered the anticipated punishment. In very late September 1475, less than 1 month after de Gadisi's arrival in the city, the pontifical commissioner decided to leave Trent and move to Riviera too, outside Hindrebach's jurisdiction. The choice of city seemed a rather delicate one, since Riviera too was known as the established general headquarters of the Ashkenazi Jewish community of northern Italy, actively mobilized some time before, in their efforts to exonerate the accused from any responsibility in Simonino's murder. It was also foreseeable that the bishop would spare no pains in representing the apostolic functionary as being under the thumb of the Jews. And Hindrebach lost no time in stressing the unsuitability of de Gadisi's decision. In a letter to the humanist friend Raffaele Zovenzani, the Bishop of Trent, Hindrebach, noted that the reasons for the commissioner's de Gadisi's move to Riviera too were just phony excuses and that the presence of the Jews gathered in the city at that time was highly suspicious. Before leaving Trent, Commissioner de Gadisi sent his one-eyed notary to Israel Wolfgang to inform him, Wolfgang, of his de Gadisi's intentions and later availability. De Gadisi, who intended to leave for Rome as quickly as possible to confer with the Pope and try to get him to stop the trials, is said to have warned the Saxon convert just in time for Wolfgang to reach Riviera too. In fact, the commissioner wished to take Wolfgang with him to see Sixtus IV, considering Wolfgang's testimony of fundamental importance. At Rome, Israel Wolfgang is also thought to have been assisted financially, as usual, by Fustunger. In the meantime, Wolfgang was to maintain his contacts with the commissioner and keep him informed of everything going on at Bonconsiglio, sending regular epistolary reports to his protector, Salomone Depiov, who was well able to make best use of them. But the most important recommendation was that Salomone should do everything in his power to enable the women to escape from their enforced confinement in Samuel's home. With the departure from Trent and Fustunger, who continued, cautiously and with circumspection, to watch the Gadisi and his retinue in their every move, Israel Wolfgang became the only Jew, although formally converted, left in the city, able to render any assistance to the women and other detainees. He was perfectly aware of the delicate nature of this role. Although he was able to leave Trent without impediment, reaching liberty on other, safer shores, the young painter from Brandenburg was not prepared to abandon the dangerous mission which he had voluntarily assumed. He was certainly not lacking in either courage or recklessness. He is believed to have remained at Trent, engaged in his desperate attempt to save the women defendants, at the risk of his life, to the bitter end. Immediately upon his arrival at Treviers too, the Apostolic Commissioner ordered the Bishop of Trent to free the prisoners without delay, particularly the women and children, and he prohibited subjecting them to torture. At the same time, the Jews presented Batista de Gudis with an appeal disputing the validity of the trials, signed by Jacob de Rive and Jacob de Brescia. They were ready to accept it, instructing Hinderbach to respond to 13 counts in an indictment accusing him, among other things, of bringing the trials solely to misappropriate the property of the condemned, estimated at 20,000 florins. The efforts expended to cause problems for the inquisitorial machinery set up at Trent enjoyed an initial success on the 12th of October 1475, when Sixtus IV himself, at the request of the Jews gathered at Treviers too, instructed Hinderbach to release the incarcerated women and children, said to be confined in precariously unhealthy conditions, and whom Sixtus believed to be innocent. De Gudis, for his part, invited Giovanni de Fondo, the notary at the Trent trials, to appear before him to testify as a witness. The notary's refusal was clear and immediate. Giovanni in fact maintained that he feared for his life. The Jews at Treviers too would not hesitate to have him murdered. In the meantime, Fastunger, alias Salomone de Campo Zampiro, reaching Val Lagurina together with the Apostolic Commissioner, abandoned Treviers too immediately to travel to Verona in an attempt to procure the services of Gianmarco Rimondi, one of the best lawyers in the city. Having obtained an appointment, Fastunger explained to the Veronese jurist, Rimondi, that, in the cause of the Jews of Trent, he could count on the support of illustrious Roman prelates, and that even the Apostolic Commissioner himself had only arrived in the area thanks to the considerable financial commitments assumed by the German-origin Jewish community to ensure the Commissioner's very appointment before the Pope. Rimondi was offered a fee at the rate of 3 florins a day to overcome his foreseeable hesitation, but to no avail. Rimondi had no intention at all of taking the case. At Trent, Israel Wolfgang had an unexpected meeting. Waiting for him one morning under the portico of Samuel Eschbank was a German Jew whom Wolfgang had met some time back, in his uncle's house at Erlangen, near Nuremberg. The German Jew told him that he, too, had converted to Christianity, taking the Christian name of Giovanni Pietro by baptismal deed, registered at Mantua, but that he had remained faithful in one way or another to the faith of his fathers. To allay suspicion, he told people that he had been moved to visit Trent by the miracles of Little Simon, but had, in reality, been sent by the general headquarters of the German Jews at Treviers too to make contact with Israel Wolfgang. In particular, he had been instructed on his mission in Trent by no less a personage than the usual Salomone de Piov, and with him, Aronda Castellanovito. The latter was to be tried and condemned in 1488 for contempt of the Christian religion, together with the other heads of the Ashkenazi community of the Duchy of Milan. The Mantuan convert known as Giovanni Pietro asked Israel Wolfgang to place him in contact with the women detainees and to obtain useful information from them. He moreover wished to obtain first-hand news about the goings-on at Bonconsiglio. Promptly satisfied, Giovanni Pietro, was successful in meeting secretly with Brunetta, Samuel of Nuremberg's obstinate widow, and asked her whether she and the other prisoners had been subjected to torture, despite the intimations of the commissioner and the Pope. But there was not much time left, not even to organize one last desperate attempt to arrange for the woman's escape and conveyance to safety. The meeting between Israel Wolfgang and Giovanni Pietro de Manfava, the German Jew from Erlangen, was held on the 18th of October. 2 days later, the Trent trials were officially reopened, on Hinderbach's initiative, with the explicit consent of the court at Innsbruck. 1 week after that, Israel Wolfgang was already in trouble, betrayed by Lazaro de Cervalli and Isaac Oda Griteldive Dira, Angelo de Verona's servants, as well as by Mose de Franconia, teacher of Tobias' children, and Joave Derimsbach, the ignorant scullery boy in Tobias' kitchen, who, tortured and confessing, out of envy or spite, had accused the young Saxon painter of responsibility for little Simon's murder. Israel Wolfgang was arrested on the 26th of October while dining at the castle, calmly and with a good appetite, with the bishop's officials and courtiers. Immediately transferred to the prisons of the Bonconsiglio, he was subjected to an exuberant dose of torture to induce him to say whatever he knew or imagined. The other defendants were condemned and publicly executed between the 1st of December 1475 and the 15th of January of the following year. At the foot of the scaffold, Mose of Franconia and the coarse Joave both converted to the faith in Christ, in the hope of alleviating their own suffering. Wolfgang was, deliberately, the last to be executed, condemned by Giovanni Hinderbach's tribunal on the 19th of January 1476. Offended and feeling betrayed, Hinderbach made no exception of any kind for Wolfgang, and punished him much more harshly than even the principal defendants on trial. His body, cruelly broken on the wheel, was devoured by animals. The young Saxon painter and miniaturist, who said that he was less than 25 years old, although he looked at least 29, faced martyrdom without batting an eye, dying a death which, both in his eyes and from the point of view of that German Judaism to which he belonged, he had been taught a court to sanctify the name of God, Al-Kiddush Hashem. His death was accompanied by unflaggingly indecorous anti-Christian grimaces and a scornful profession of polemical faith. The voluntary sacrifice of Israel Wolfgang, the boy from Brandenburg, counterbalanced, or, more exactly, flanked, the involuntary sacrifice of little Simon, in a holy tragedy in which the basic elements of the plot, cruel and bloody, had been composed centuries before, in Hebrew and Yiddish, in German and in Latin, in the valleys washed by the muddy waters of the Rhine and the Main, the Rhone and the Danube, the Adige and the Ticino, where it was said that the god of the rivers claimed their innocent victims every year. Yes, I am perfectly persuaded and convinced that killing Christian children and consuming their blood and swallowing it was a good thing. If I could obtain the blood of a Christian boy for our Passover feast, of course I would drink it and eat it, if I could do so without attracting too much attention. Know ye that, although I have been baptized, I, Israel, son of Mer, may he rest in peace, a Jew of Brandenburg, intend, and have established in my soul, that I wish to die a true Jew. I had myself baptized when I saw that I had gotten caught, and in doubt that I might be condemned to death, believing that I could avoid it, as actually happened. Know ye, therefore, that I, Israel the Brandenburg, Jew, do not consider anything believed and observed by the Christian religion to be true at all. I believe with an unshakable faith that the religion of Israel is correct and holy. But not everything had gone wrong, at least from Israel the Brandenburg's point of view. Not a single week had passed since his arrest before the young Saxon Jew, in his cell, was informed that Hinderbach had finally given in, perhaps in part to counterbalance foreseeable criticism of his decision to reopen the trials, and had consented to release the incarcerated woman's children. These were Mose and Salomone, the children of Verona and of Dolcetta, Seligman, mayor of Würzburg's young boy, Samuel de Nuremberg's daughter-in-law Anna's young boy, still in diapers, and the numerous offspring of the late Tobias, whose four children were named Yosk, Mose, Chairman David. An envoy from the Apostolic Commissioner appeared at the castle of Bonconsiglio on the 2nd of November and took delivery of the children, who were later taken to Rovereto and entrusted to the Jews. Little is known of their fate. Many of them were probably taken back to Germany and adopted by relatives or persons known by them, and seem to have disappeared from the pages of history. Only Mose and Salomone, Angelo de Verona's children, remained safely in Italy, entrusted to the Ashkenazi community which had worked so actively to obtain their release. Following the confessions of Brunetta, Samuel de Nuremberg's widow, and the other women, followed by their conversion to Christianity, which occurred in January 1477, attempts to return the children to their mothers proved fruitless. Bella, Anna and Sarah, who had, at the time, voluntarily entrusted their children to the Jews of Rovereto, now that they were converted and baptized under the names of Elisabetta, Suzanne, and Chiara, wanted them back urgently, ceding to the pressures of those who wished them to have the children baptized. Pope Sixtus IV himself, by a bull of the 20th of June 1478, addressed to Hinderbach, exhorted him to take all steps to ensure that they might be returned to the recently converted women, together with their dowries. The children were to be baptized. But his attempts in this direction were too late. It was like closing the barn door when the horse has already been stolen. We still wish, and we enjoin you to it with the same authority, that you shall use all diligence to ensure that the children of the condemned Jews be returned to their baptized mothers, together with their dowry, wherever that might be found, compelling any opponent or rebel by means of ecclesiastical censure and other means granted by law. But the last scene of the drama was yet to be enacted. The drama finally concluded with the solemn appearance at the baptismal font of Salomone, the physician to be as feeble-minded servant. The poor imbecile, deemed incapable of understanding or consenting, had survived the trial for little Simon's murder because he gave no indication of knowing or remembering anything about it. Now, to mark the occasion of the feeble-minded Salomon's baptism, under the name of Giovanni, in a crowded ceremony in the Chiesa di San Pietro at Trent, it was the common desire of all that he might also recover the light of the intellect. The body of the sainted little martyr Simon was invoked aloud to perform this one last appropriate miracle.